Hey everybody, welcome back to another Bald Movie. This week, Jim and I, for the first time in a long time, are able to do a first-run movie because Spike Lee's new joint, The Five Bloods, debuted on Netflix just last Friday. It was supposed to have a limited theatrical run, but COVID came, and Spike took a look at the disproportionate deaths that black folk are suffering in Corona and said, nope, we're just going to release it on Netflix. So we were able to finally get a first-run movie. It was, of course, written and directed by Spike Lee. Credited writers also include Danny Bilson, Paul DeMeo, and Kevin Wilmont. It stars Delroy Lindo, which you might recognize from Cider House Rules, Get Shorty, The Core. And he's also worked with Spike on Malcolm X, Crooklyn, and Clockers. What's the one that you recognized him for? We're just talking about this.
A bunch of stuff. I mean, he's Gone in 60 Seconds. He's in that.
Yeah, he's the cop in that, I think.
Yeah. Congo. Like, he's in a bunch of shit.
Yeah, Congo. But
the
90s, just on the Australian disaster thing, we saw him get burnt up stepping outside the core capsule in Core.
Right, that's where everyone comes from.
Yeah, his most famous role, The Core. Also, the rounding out the Five Bloods is Clark Peters, which, you know, Bald Move fans will recognize as Cool Lester Smooth from The Wire, and also Treme. Norm Lewis, who I guess is theater famous. You know, he's done a lot of like theater work. This is his first feature film. He's also notable for being the first black man to portray the Phantom in Phantom of the Opera on Broadway. Isaiah Whitlock Jr. and shit. We all know Clay Davis from The Wire, right?
Sure do.
We all know who we're talking about here. And then the final Five Bloods, Chadwick Boseman, who of course played Jackie Robinson in 42, James Brown and Get On Up, and of course the Black Panther. Also, Jonathan Majors plays the son of Delroy Lindo, who joins the Five Bloods on their pilgrimage back to Vietnam, and a major antagonist, Jean Reno, which everybody knows from Leon, The Big Blue, Godzilla, Mission Impossible, Da Vinci Code, lots of stuff. Jim, to me, this felt like a mashup of like Apocalypse Now, the movie Three Kings, and Deliverance, kind of all kind of stewed in a big racial pot. And I really like the film. I think the film does have some flaws and is a little messy, but I'm not even sure if that's not part of the creative decision-making process. But what did you think before we get much further?
It's funny how many white people are in those movies you just mentioned. Because that's the thing that's important here, right? Is the perspective. Because I've seen movies, you know, Apocalypse Now is one of like the classic Vietnam era war films. And I don't think I've ever seen this perspective. And I think that's, you know, why Spike Lee made this film, is because they don't tell the stories. Hollywood does not tell the stories. And there's commentary in this film about Hollywood not telling the stories of the black soldiers, and their plight. So yeah, I was impressed by the perspective and the message and the acting, specifically. I think, goddamn, Delroy Lindo is fan-fucking-tastic in this movie, even though for the vast majority of this film, he's kind of a reprehensible guy.
He's very damaged. He's got a lot of fucking dings in the whole intellectual and emotional bodywork there,
And those things manifest in ways that I don't agree with, but, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's an outstanding performance, as is everyone's here. And I really enjoyed the film, though I do find it a little bit messy, especially when it comes to like the editing. I think it's disjointed. It's a Spike Lee disjoint. it doesn't feel as polished as a lot of films that I've seen, and especially not something like Apocalypse Now. Like, that's a masterclass in filmmaking. But I think, you know, Spike Lee does this, and he did this with Black Klansman too. It's like he's got this powerful resolution to the film, the powerful ending to really jolt the audience into awareness when they're sitting in the theater, or in this case in their living rooms, watching his films.
Yeah, and he's got this like interesting thing that I don't know was there in his early filmmaking, where he does a lot of this like Quentin Tarantino style smash cut fourth wall breaks to like stock film reference images to like punctuate when the Five Bloods are talking about some historic, you know, black military hero, Congressional Medal of Honor winner. Fuck, we don't know who that is. So like, bam, hit us with his service record shot. And, you know, like if we're mentioning these black athletes, let's show him up on the podium. Like they do a lot. He does a lot of these kind of inserts, like fourth wall breaking in universe inserts to kind of like drive home some of these points. And yeah, it is like there's other thing I was worried about, like, and especially at the halfway point, I'm like, oh man, like I just know everything that's going to happen in the final like act and a half of this. Like he's telegraphed everything. You've got, I don't want to say any more to spoil it. Although, like I said, the movie kind of spoils itself. And every single time one of those things actually happened, I was like, oh yeah, here it comes. But like 30 seconds into it, I'd forgotten, because it's not the surprise of the thing that happens is not the point. The point is the men's reaction to what happens and their raw performance and emotion. And I got, even though I saw everything coming, I got really emotionally affected two or three times in this film, especially in the end. And that's what I'm saying. Like, I wonder like if the messiness, disjointed, disorganized feel of the editing, because like the film's technically proficient, like fucking Spike Lee went and shot a war movie in the jungles of Vietnam. You got the sun, the chopper in front of the sun shot. He's got like, he's just really technically solid.
That archival footage feel that he does with the old actors and the young Chadwick.
Fucking love like, it. Yeah. So I almost wonder like if that's a commentary on the war itself, which is kind of a disorganized, being pulled in many different directions, kind of, you know, not so much a cohesive plan, but just kind of improvise and, oh shit, what's the, oh, if Americans don't like this, we better start changing this. Oh, better have a massive, I wonder if it was like, they deliberately assembled it to look that, to resemble the kind of psyche of the Vietnam War itself. But then again, maybe that's just a happy accident, because, it looked like, you know, maybe it need like you said, maybe it need a little bit of time and more time in the editing bay, but maybe he wanted something more raw. And
he's definitely experimenting with this stuff, because like when I think back to Black Klansman, that had some insert archival footage in there,
sure,
from like Charlottesville protest, and but that was used at the very end to really drive the point home. And there was some other stuff at the end of that too, but this is an interesting blend of like the storytelling with the archival footage kind of mixed throughout the whole movie. You know, it's not just coming in at the end to really hammer home the point, though they do it at the end and they do it at the beginning, but they also do it throughout. And I feel like it was effective in that regard, though I will say, I think that opening beginning is better at creating a sense of scale, of injustice and brutality than it is at educating me, because everything is snapping by so fast that a name here or there is not going to mean anything to me as an admittedly ignorant of black struggles in America and in the Vietnam War person that I am.
Yeah. But I mean, some of it just like the stuff that like you kind of absorb, like, you know, they have a couple stats, like, you know, they have a framing where they have Hanoi Hanna, which was the, you know, famous propagandist of the Vietnam War, you know, broadcasting morale poison to our troops from the North Vietnamese perspective. And as I found the case in The Watchmen, which dealt with this phenomenon in World War One. You know, they mention like at stuff like, you know, black GI, you are 12% of the American population, and yet you account for 38% of its fighting force. This is not like, and they showed the effect it had on the black troops. Like, this is like really, this was really fucking effective, because it's propaganda that happened to be true and hitting home. And I thought like that stuff was interesting. There's a lot of like commentary about black men and fathers and sons. There's also some commentary about like how racial injustice is very geographically contextual.
Sure.
Because like, you know, when you have black men fighting in a war, and then, you know, after the war, you have them intellectually fighting and throwing back names and stuff and having conflict and deciding who's the more oppressed. It's like really hard to argue with the, you know, person living in Vietnam that, hey, you should cut me some slack because I'm a Black American. I came to fight this war like 40 years ago.
Yeah, and I deserve your gold because of it. Like, maybe we should talk about the plot of this film. Because it is a commentary on social injustice, but it is also just a pretty good buddies going back to honor their fallen comrade and maybe score some gold in the process.
It's an adventure film. And like, the other thing that's interesting is like, I was thinking as I was watching this, especially the early going where it's very, you know, these old coots just getting together and having a good old time. I'm like thinking like, man, I've seen 36 like white versions of this, like City Slickers, Grumpy Old Men, Space Cowboys, The Bucket List, which, you know, they throw in more, you know, they start to throw in.
Oh, that's Morgan Freeman, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Just like Apocalypse Now has Lawrence Fishburne. Uh-huh. They have a black guy, you know, they're represented. But like, and I'm sure there's probably ones that exist, but I can't think of a single other movie where a bunch of like, four old black guys get together and have an adventure.
You kind of need, I don't know, adventures, sort of imply some levity and some fun, and there's not much in the Black American experience that is fun.
But on the other hand, like, you know, there's still joy and art to be had there. And I think the first act of the movie leads with that.
They do.
Let me break down the action just in case you're kind of wondering, like, what this film is all about. So the titular Five Bloods are five black men who went to Vietnam serving in the first infantry. And they were tasked by the command, I think it was a CIA operation. Their squad was assigned to go and recover some sensitive cargo from a downed military plane. And they landed. It was very hot. You know, they landed in the middle of a lot of hot action. One of their leader, Stormin Norman, was killed in the action, and they buried him there. And also found that the goal of the operation was a chest of gold, intended to buy off some of the Vietnam people to support America. They buried both their fallen brother and the chest of gold, and intended to return later to retrieve it for themselves, but the area was napalmed and all the landmarks were removed, so that was all that they were unable to recover the gold. And now, like 40 years later, there was a mudslide in the area. The fin of the aircraft that they were supposed to recover the gold from has been exposed by satellite, and they've gotten wind of it, and they have a plan to all reunite, the four surviving Bloods, to reunite in Vietnam and recover Stormin Norman, the body of Stormin Norman. That's the cover. And also something that's very important to them. And also go back and get those gold bars. Mm-hmm. That's the first 5 minutes of the movie, and the rest of the movie you have to watch to find out. So let's talk about some of this stuff. Some of the archival stuff is really effective. Like, they opened up with Muhammad Ali's speech about, you know, why would I go fight in Vietnam? It's not my war. You know, Vietnamese haven't done anything to me. Like, when I compare, like, what the white man has done to me at home, as a pretty powerful backdrop. But they also have, like, a lot on the Vietnam side where they show, like, a lot of the different, like, casual atrocities. Like, I've seen that picture of the Arvin officer executing that Viet Cong right in the middle of the streets. I've seen it a million times. I did not know it was a video. And like, the video of this guy getting his brains blown out is fucking horrific. And just like, you know, I've also seen the pictures of the children, you know, running naked from a village that's been napalmed. And I got to see the video of that. That too is horrific. Just a lot of stuff that they hit you with to kind of like set the tone. You know, like, here is what the black soldiers' experience was in Vietnam. Here is what the Vietnamese soldiers from both sides' experience was in Vietnam. And they do that just really effortlessly as they're introducing us to the Five Bloods.
Yeah, I don't know. The intro to me was a little too quick. I wasn't able to pick up on a lot of it, or at least I wasn't able to pull out as much as I felt like I should have been pulling out. I just got a general sense of the thing, but
yeah, and I might have a little bit of advantage because, like, I don't know a lot about the Vietnam War. My dad was a naval corpsman, a Vietnam era naval corpsman, but he didn't really see a lot of action. He got in at the very end of the war and served most of his time on hospital ships and field hospitals. But I did, you know, I've talked to him a little bit, and I've also just recently seen the Ken Burns, you know, kind of authoritative Vietnam War documentary. So a little of this, I had a little bit of the, you know, some of these, I had a little bit more Velcro for this stuff to stick onto.
Yeah, I got none of that. Like, my dad was also in the Vietnam War, but I don't know. I haven't talked to him much about it, but I know basically nothing about the Vietnam War other than it was largely perceived as a folly by the time it was over, any, you know, throughout its entire history, essentially. And now I guess I know a little bit more about the black perspective on the Vietnam War.
And I thought the way they introduced the Five Bloods, just like, again, it's like it was, you know, these four guys getting together for drinks, you know, like they're all kind of trickling in and catching back up, and you know, they're just having conversation, they're talking about different stuff, and then there's an uncomfortable exchange with one of the beggar children. And that's another thing they effortlessly do, kind of like in the margins, the idea that, like, the Vietnam War is not necessarily over for the Vietnamese, because children are still being maimed. People are still being killed and maimed by the landmines and unexploded ordnance that's all throughout that country.
Well, I mean, it's not over for anybody. I mean, if you look at, like, the relationship that Paul has with his son David, that's all tainted by this. Like,
yeah,
Paul comes back a broken man, essentially. And you know, the ideals that he had are shattered, and that just leaks into the next generation of kids, right? Like,
right.
He's told him constantly, like, you know, he doesn't mean that much to him. And so that kid's fucked up too.
And he came back from the war broken mentally, but also they suggest, because Paul's got, you find out throughout the film that Paul's got cancer. And, you know, it's a fact that a lot of the chemical agents that the GIs were exposed to in Vietnam, I mean, you can, it's a matter of VA record that there's a lot of health risk that was associated in fighting that war. And I think we're also starting to see the same thing about the various adventures in the Middle East, where, like, you know, exposure to depleted uranium and you know, like the conditions and fighting wars and all that stuff can really do murder to your body and your lungs and your nervous system. And they have that, but they also show, and here's where I wasn't sure how I felt about it. I liked the fact that one of the black guys was a MAGA, a Trump, and they had a funny thing where, like, the guy that plays Lester, Clark Peters, is like, "Oh, you're the one." And they smash cut to archival footage of Trump at a rally, and they photoshopped Paul in there, and he's like, "Oh yeah, you were the grinning dude in the front row." And then they smash cut right then to him clapping and cheering. Kind of, like, play a little bit of lip service to, like, why a black man might be very conservative in 2020. But then they kind of undercut it by just making him just so, like, damaged and insane that it kind of takes away from, like, well,
I think,
can we just not take a black conservative seriously? Like, there's reasons. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with them, but they have, a lot of them have valid and well thought out reasons for being conservative.
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to the same reasons that poor white people in this country also have for following a dude like that, which is they just simply want to change. Things haven't been working for them so far.
Voting Democrat for 50 years and where it's got us. Yeah.
What's the status quo doing for me? That kind of stuff. So, man, I had a very awkward Lyft ride one time with a black driver who was conservative and was wondering why I was not. And it was, I know those people exist. It was strange. Yeah. It was like this weird cognitive dissonance that I had in my head. Mm-hmm. Like, I assume you would not be for this guy who is so clearly just a racist asshole if you were black, but it exists.
Yeah.
And I think like a lot of the things that this movie is doing shows sort of the importance of brotherhood. And especially what that means to the Black community as they fight mm-hmm. social injustice in America. I think it's important not to be a force divided. You know, it's united we stand, divided we fall, that kind of thing. And you look at Paul in this movie, and you see that he has allowed himself to become divided from, and a lot of these guys divided from the brotherhood that made them so strong under Storm and Norman, right? Like,
and it's all guilt and shame that split them,
right? Right, and that's driving itself as a wedge into the next generation, and you see how like just this whole system crumbles when people start mm-hmm. to become divided. And I think that's kind of the message that I got from the film. And granted, I am, like I said, very ignorant on these topics. And so when I saw this, I saw these people who had been divided by their ideology, divided by their experiences, and were no longer in a position to fight, to protest, to push back against any kind of injustice.
Yeah, there's a quote from, a prominent Black civil rights activist. I can't remember their name, but is along the paraphrase of like, America... You know, America has never been for me, but like I dream of the America to be like, you know, kind of like that's embodied in the Storm and Norman. Like he's this almost prophetic figure that like teaches these men, like, you know, you get the idea that maybe he went to a historic Black college and for whatever reason, he's very educated and articulate about all the different history and the civil rights struggle. And, you know, there's this line about like, you know, Norman also schooled us about like the anti-communist nonsense or the anti-socialist nonsense. And mm-hmm. And also like there's a scene where the Bloods find out in Vietnam that Martin Luther King's been killed. I think they probably found out from the Vietnam propaganda.
That's how they frame it in the
Viet Cong movie, propaganda. Yeah. And like, you know, and he kind of helps him turn that corner about like, you know, this rage and anger and like, well, what are you going to use it? What are you going to do with it? And, you know, when they find this gold and they talk about like, you know, well, we're just going to steal it. I think that's even Paul, because Paul's the one who's obsessed with like, you know, doesn't want to be like a neighborhood gangster, doesn't want to be a chain snatcher, doesn't want to be a backstabbing fiend. And he's like the one's like, oh, we're just going to snatch this. He's like, no, this is reparations for our people. We're going to take this back and we're going to put it into our community. That's a war of his current ideology, because he's the one foremost of like, fuck, yeah, this is reparations for me. Mm-hmm. This $20 million is going to like, yeah, it's going to enrich my Black ass, you know, rather than the community.
That's the thing. It's like your motivations can kind of turn in on themselves at some point. You know, where like, yeah, he's going to get his. And he doesn't want to be, you know, like the chain snatcher like you were talking about. But at the same time, like, that's not doing any favors to his community at large, right? Like, getting yours doesn't do anything to help your brother.
Yeah. I really liked, because I said there's a lot of interesting stuff, and I think this is the most emotionally powerful stuff, is the relationship Paul has with his son. Because you find out that, like, I think one of the messy, disjointed feelings of the film comes in that like these characters behave as if they know all the information, because they do, but we as an audience are puzzled, like, goddamn, why does Paul hate his son so much? This guy, look at this guy, he's very impressive, he's gone to historic Black college, I think it's Morehead University, which is Spike Lee's
Morehouse,
right? Is his alma mater. Uh-huh. And you know, like, why would a man not be proud of this son? And you find out that like it's all comes back to like it's like a Tywin Lannister situation. His mother died in childbirth, and his father literally has never forgiven him for it. Plus, he started off like, you know, like maybe he's crazy from the war. He found a woman that could kind of like heal parts of that psyche, and then she was taken from him by this son that he brought into the world. But there's still like, I love the scene where you're introduced to him and they film it. Spike Lee films it as if this kid, this grown man, he's 30 years old, but he looks like he's a little boy sitting in front of these towering like figures of his father and his friends and all their accomplishments, and he's just sitting here like small, filmed from down low while his father's like, you know, lecturing him on this and that. But then when they first get in the jungle, you see his dad like obsessively like spraying him down with bug spray, you know. Like, I don't want you to get bit, you know, put on this, you know, you don't want to get fucking typhoid fever or whatever, you know, malaria or whatever. Like, so.
And that's you get the story hits. Of this movie, right? For Paul, it's that journey. It's that journey back from the brink.
Yeah.
Or like that journey back into the Brotherhood.
Yeah. Yeah. And he loves, he does bury it underneath everything, loves the son. He find that out the very, which I thought was emotionally powerful. Him, you know, his son goes back and, you know, he's a school teacher and he's reading this letter. That Otis has given to him, and it explains all these things. Like, I've loved you this whole time. I just didn't have the words, and I just thought that was really powerful. But like, how that kept on tugging back between, like, yeah, I love you and I'm proud of you, and like, oh my God, you're not doing what I'm telling you to, and you're scaring me. A lot of stuff that I remember. Like 2 years ago, I read that Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me, and he talks about like how angry his parents would get with him when he would do stupid kid stuff like out on the streets, because to them, like, they were hyper aware that, like, you're a black person in this world, and it's either living in like East Baltimore, it's like this world's gonna try to kill you if you do everything right. Every time you step out of line, every time you act weak, every time you play the fool, every time you fuck up, it's another chance, like the world is going to get you and kill you. And that fear manifests itself as this furious anger. And I felt like that's the same way. Like, Paul was so fucking afraid of what the world would do to his boy that, like, it came across as this ferocious, like, you know, like, relentless, like, you're never going to be good enough. You're never going to do things well enough. You're always going to be soft and weak. And I thought that was just really that tug of war between him wanting to love and be proud of his son, and also that fear that, like, his son is going to be a sucker. His son's going to do something to get him all killed. I thought that was just really powerful. Paul's a very frustrating character because most of the conflict stems from him just unable to be cool about something.
Like that chicken scene, right? Like,
yeah, and that's like a that's a thing. It's like a God, he serves a lot of the tension for the film, because I was like, you know, what is going to be the fatal explosion? And, you know, like, things go real wrong when the Bloods get in a fight, and one of the Bloods starts slowly back, like, kind of like trying to like shame them all into Brotherhood, steps on a landmine and explodes. And then these three white kids, French kids, that are, you know, from wealthy backgrounds, and they're essentially doing summer work dismantling landmines and exploding ordnance, to come across them because they hear the explosion. And Paul decides to just take them all hostage. And maybe he's going to kill them. Like, I don't think he even knows what he's going to do and how far he's going to go. But, like, I kept on wondering. It's like, God damn, Paul, why don't you just keep to the fucking cover story?
Yeah.
Like, it's not like gold bars are spilled everywhere, and they like just say, like, hey, yeah, we're here to recover our fallen brother. Here's his remains, and we're trying to get back to this, and now this has happened to, like, he just goes to the most insane course of action. And then everything people try to do to, like, stop him or put him on rails is considered like this arch betrayal.
Yeah.
But then I also get the idea that, it's almost self-sacrifice at the end, like him going off in the gold and just running off into the woods with it. Like, what was his plan? Like, at some subconscious level, was he not trying to split the enemy forces away from his brothers? Like, he's like, I'm a dead man. Like, you find out he's got cancer. He's probably going to die anyway. Like, I felt like that was an act of self-sacrifice. And then he finds himself with this vision he has of Storm and Norman at the end.
It doesn't help him. And B, he never consciously gives voice to that. If that's his intention, right? He says all the opposite things, like, you know, fuck you guys, you're all backstabbers. My own son is a backstabber. It's the last thing he says to him. Like, there's, you know, it's weird. It's interesting that you bring up like the relationship between Paul and the rest of the group here, because I recently watched Dave Chappelle's 8:46. Special. I don't even know what to call it. It's not a comedy. There's one joke. There's one pussy joke in there, but that's about it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The rest of it is commentary on, you know, the Floyd death recently and the aftermath of that and the protests. But, you know, one of the things that comes out of that, one of the most powerful things he says is that the black community does not need me to speak for them. They'll speak for themselves. The streets will speak for themselves. I trust you guys. And that's the thing. Like, I don't feel like Paul ever trusted any of these guys or they trusted him. And and maybe to lesser degrees, like, okay, you know, Otis didn't trust Norm or something. Like, there's a lot of lack of trust here. And I feel like that's the thing that needs to be the baseline to bring the people together is that trust. Like, we all have each other's backs. And that's the thing that I felt for right up until the end of the movie, like where they're, you know, taking up defensive positions inside a temple, I felt was lacking through most of it. It always felt like this could crumble at any moment because nobody was working together.
Yeah, and they do come together at the end. And I even thought Paul, like, you're right. He's muttering all this nonsense. And he goes off on these like half thought out tirades throughout the movie. And when he finally goes off on his final one, goes off in the jungle, like he starts like saying a bunch of crazy shit. But like as the monologue goes, like there's this point where like the camera rotates into his face and he stops just like general, like just like shouting at the world and starts like giving this like searing monologue into the camera. And he starts making a lot of fucking sense. Mm-hmm. And I got the idea. It's like, you know, like where did this lack of trust come from? I don't think he trusts himself because he blames himself for killing.
Yeah, no, you're
the
right.
Group's spiritual core. And he couldn't trust his brothers with that secret. Because if he'd have come clean that day, it's like, oh my God, this Viet Cong ambushed us. I turned around and like sprayed and I got Norman the guts. Like they all would have told him. They all would have absolved him of that. Shit happens in war. It's not your fault. It's like it's if anything, it's the people in Washington's fault for having us out there. And you know, poking our nose in this business. But he didn't trust himself, didn't trust his brothers, and that, you know, like the cancer that's building up in his body felt like it was building up in his mind. But you contrast that with like Clay Davis, I can't remember his Isaiah Whitlock's character. You know, several times he's like, I ain't gonna, you know, he's like, he refuses to bend over to pick up the gold. Uh-huh. He refuses to dig because he's got the, like, he explicitly says in the halfway point of the film, like, they're talking about like, oh, remember that one guy that jumped under Gage? He goes, I ain't ever going to do that for any of you. I ain't going to do it. But like at the end of the movie, he does without even thinking. He just jumps and eats that grenade. Mm-hmm. And there is like something like this, no matter how fractured a community or a group of individuals can get, like when the shit is down, you do dig deep and you can find that. And like I said, I do think that like, I don't know. Like, there's definitely a lot of Paul just being half-cocked crazy person, just like wandering off of the gold. But also, there's also a little bit of, I think, sacrifice there because there was no end game to that. It was just, you know, just a divide the forces to give his brothers a fighting chance, I think. My God, he got fucking ventilated.
Yeah, he did.
That's as bad as an execution that I've seen since like Sonny at the toll booth, man.
I mean, they're out in the jungle. You got five guys with machine guns. I couldn't help but think like
he's digging his own grave. Yeah.
Like out in the woods and they're just blasting away, man.
Yeah, man. It was fucking intense. A lot of the action, and then I think that again is like a little bit Vietnam. Like, you know, you always say that you hear us hear this about war. It's like war is like these long and terminal, stretches of boredom that's punctuated by intense, brief flashes of just sheer terror. Mm. And that's how, like, all of the action scenes, such as they are in this, felt like. Like, everything's panic, nothing, you know. But also, like, the fact that, like, these guys, you could tell these guys actually were soldiers, you know. Mm-hmm. When they finally do get guns in their hands, you know, they're shouldering, they're aiming, they're firing effectively. And it felt like, even though these guys are old guys, I felt like, yeah, that's about how this would go. Um,
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers have a chance to exercise their rights under the Patreon pact we've made by voting for the next Pulp movie that Jim and I will be covering. If you're one of the elite few backers at the executive producer level, don't miss your chance to influence us. Hurry over to patreon.com/baldmove and vote in the latest movie poll before it closes on Wednesday morning.
And for all other club members, we've got an all-new episode of Lunch with Jim and Aaron this Friday afternoon. Catch the live stream at 1 p.m. to interact with us and your fellow munchers over on Patreon, or you can wait for the podcast to drop later that day.
If you want even more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly Lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Yeah. I think it also helped. I really love the technique of having the old guys fighting with the young, you know, Chad Boswick.
That's Boseman. Not his
Chad,
name, yeah.
Chadwick Boseman. God damn it. Speaking of fractured mental states, I really like that creative choice to have just the old ass dudes with the young guy who died back there. Yeah. And then at the end, because I'm like, I wonder if this was like a budget decision or something like that. But then at the end, they do the like you thing you expect them to do, like they de-age everybody to show them in the you know how they actually looked in their prime. But I thought that actually sold them as warriors when they had to fight like in the desperate gun battles at the end of the film.
Yeah, I'm surprised I haven't seen this in other movies that do flashbacks.
Yeah,
it's used to really good effect here because it shows that you know they've never left this place. It's been with them for the last 40 years, and I think. When I first saw what they were doing here, I didn't realize what it was. And so I saw them and I'm like, man, they just did a piss poor job of de-aging these people. They didn't even take the gray out of their beards. What are they doing? And then the second time they do it, I'm like, okay.
Uh-huh.
Because the first time is like just a quick shot of them in a helicopter, like an Apocalypse Now kind of Flight of the Valkyries moment. Mm-hmm. But it's real quick. And so I thought, well, maybe they did something here.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns out I just wasn't getting the point until the second time around.
And I was thinking about them, I was watching and I was thinking, you know, that actually is how I remember my youth. Like when I think about like things that happened to me as a teenager and a young man, I never think of it like I always think of like my present body and self in those images. Do you like when you think about like when you were 13, do you think of like what you looked like and dressed like as a 13-year-old? It's always me, a 43-year-old man in the 13-year-old memory insert. It's weird.
And I felt like, too.
Yeah, I think like that's just how people process that shit. It's always you,
yeah,
your current point of view, which is also I think why a lot of people get stuck in those, like, you know, burn themselves on hot memory stoves, because you take what you would do now with all the knowledge and wisdom with what you did when you were 8 or 9 or 13. It's like, Jesus Christ, what a fucking shit show. I was
25.
yeah. I thought it was a really powerful, first of all, it was funny, kind of like a comedic technique, but then it get more and more poignant as they kept doing it throughout the movie.
Yeah, so I got what they were doing there, but there's there's something I'm not sure what they're trying to get at. And it's the opioid stuff. So Otis is taking OxyContin, and he claims that he's not addicted to it, which it seems like he's not, given, you know, how easily he dumps it out and then doesn't need it for the rest of the movie, essentially. What are they trying to do? Are they trying to tie opioid epidemic somehow to black oppression? Because I didn't understand why that was even in a part of the film.
I think it's like, isn't this like Golden Triangle stuff? Like it goes like, and wasn't that like part of the big heroin trade? Like it, you know, the stuff like in American Gangster smuggled back on Vietnam. I think it's almost like a circle of life kind of thing. War never ends. Like, you know, like the Vietnam War was a major vector for trafficking drugs in the United States. And now these old Vietnam vets are all, you know, taking opioids because of their chronic pain or whatnot. And, you know,
is there an irony to that?
I think there was a little bit of that you're supposed to understand. But I thought it was what I thought that's too, is like when he poured those out, I'm like, Jesus Christ, when your hip starts acting up, you're going to want that. And it's also played off as a laugh when Isaiah Whitlock's character reveals that he's had a thing of OxyContin the whole time for his back pain.
Yeah.
And lets Otis have it at towards the end of the movie.
Yeah, I felt bad for Otis the whole time. Like, once he dumped that oxy and he's got to hike, I don't know how many miles with how many pounds of gold.
Oh,
on
my
his back.
God. They had to have been carrying like 100 pounds a piece.
Yeah.
At least, yeah, if not more.
A lot of gold.
I mean, if a couple times in the movie, I was thinking, like, man, if Paul's kid didn't show up.
Yeah.
Another 40, 50 pounds of gold on these guys might have broken some joints and stuff. Because Otis was in bad shape in that final stretch. Yeah. But I thought there's also, you know, we mentioned this, but like there's a really key scene where the Five Bloods are trying to essentially haggle over gold, but the currency is who's faced the most atrocities and oppression, and they're squaring off against these Vietnamese people, and the Vietnamese are like, okay, well, this is our gold. So thanks for digging up. Here's one bar to pay for it. And then like Paul's perspective is, you know, we came over here and in a country that wasn't ours, and we fought for rights that we didn't enjoy. And the Vietnamese are like, not persuasive. Don't give a fuck. But there's also this other thing where Otis finds out he has this daughter with his old Vietnamese lover that he had to abandon at the conclusion of the war. And she makes it a point to where, like, this weird thing where, like, America imported all this racism to Vietnamese. Like, she makes a point. It's like, you know, we didn't know the N-word. We didn't know all these slurs until you guys came here. And now when my daughter was born and she's half black, everyone knew exactly what she was and what to call her.
Yeah.
And, but on the other hand, the average Vietnamese doesn't give a shit about the plight of black Americans, because why the fuck would they?
Sure.
You know, they've got their own problems. They've got their own history of oppression, colonization. You know, Jean Reno, Renault is there, I think, to represent kind of like the nefarious French influence. The fact that Vietnamese was a French colony, and that's kind of how America got into the war. You know, like our French allies, like, hey, we got this communist deal. You guys seem to know what you're doing in Korea. Can you help us out? And, you know, that's how we got into the war in Vietnam.
Yeah, I don't know anything about that.
That's what I'm saying. Like racism is like a very contextual thing, you know.
Sure.
Like what it means to be black in America is completely different than what it would mean to be black in Vietnam or black in China or, you know, black in Sudan. You know.
Sure. And oppression is a contextual thing too. It's like,
sure.
How do you, when you got your own problems to deal with, your own struggles, how do you step in and help someone out with their own struggles? You know, can you shoulder that burden? It's like the extra 40 or 50 pounds of gold on the back that might break you. Like, I don't know. We definitely struggle with that in America. Like the black people in America since the time immemorial, the very beginning, have been oppressed, have been exploited and abused. And we've got a vast majority population of white people here who have not really stepped up to help them out with that burden. In fact, they made it worse. I like to think that's changing now. And we're on a path toward coming together as a nation, as one people, not as segregated people, and starting to work together to fix those problems. But goddamn, how many hundreds of years do we have to wait to get that done?
I don't know, because the other thing is every single time we have a minor victory, it's like the idea is like, okay, we're done now. We've done it. And like that,
and then you go back to your own struggles, right? Like,
right, right. And that's, you know, there's a point I made in one of my Three Right Turns podcasts that like it's, you know, this has been written in medical journals where these attitudes are starting to imperil white lives. Like the fact that like poor white people vote against entitlement programs and things like universal health care because they don't want the lazy black and Mexican people to have it. And they need it. They're dying of their own cancers and their own shitty drinking water and their own like fucking poor diet and environment that they're living on because they can't conceive of, you know, this is it's killing white
about.
People. This racism kills white people as you know, with increasing numbers as everybody else. But I thought that stuff was really cool. And the idea, like, they mentioned that the war is never over for people. Like, there's this character Tien, who's their guide. And it ends up becoming essentially a sixth blood by the end. And, you know, there's they make this point in the very beginning of the movie. It's like, you know, you guys came over and fought this war, but this war, you know, split families up. This was a civil war in Vietnam. And, you know, like Paul had a uncomfortable, didn't want to salute these old Viet Cong soldiers. They're essentially Vietnamese equivalents. And the guide points out, well, that's like my cousin and my uncle. And they're like, I thought you were South Vietnamese. It's like, what, you don't understand. Like this, you know, we were one country and we were split down the middle over these ideological lines. I thought that was that, and the fact that like you still got, again, it blows my mind that these landmines and unexploded ordnances are still killing, are still orphaning children and still maiming them in you know, 2020.
Yeah,
how is it?
Years later.
How is it that we can't build a washing machine that lasts 5 years, but we can bury a landmine in the ground for 60 years in the fucking jungle, and it still is capable of blowing people's limbs off? Like, can we not engineer a washing machine with that kind of tenacity?
We can, but then you have to buy one every 2 years.
Were landmines expensive? Like, I also feel like they're not. They didn't cost $50,000 a piece either. They're probably something you could stand. I mean, it's just, I don't know. It's so much easier to destroy than create, I suppose, as the old, you know, Star Trek adage that you could apply to that.
Well, I guess the positive of all this is that as more white people are affected by racism adversely, we'll all start to come together, right? There's going to be this weird inversion of like where racism starts to affect the people who are racist, and so they can't afford to be racist anymore.
Yeah.
And they have to join up with all of the people that they've been hating for so long to get some sense of equality and normality for themselves.
Yeah,
that's going to be the big positive here, is that racism will defeat itself, right?
Yeah, yeah, because, like, you know, the it's funny because I've been listening to a lot of the new Run the Jewels album, and LP, the white guy, part of the group, he's got this verse where he says, the funny thing about cages, they're not built for just one group. When they're done with that and you're still poor, they'll next come for you.
Yeah.
And I think people will realize that like, you know, like I think this, like, part of the big change about how people feel about police brutality in the last few weeks is like these protests, and there's so much caught on film. Very obviously a lot of violence is coming from the police, and it's like, you know, when a police officer pushes down a 75-year-old man for just coming up to speak to him, to like, maybe his angry words, maybe he's going to jam a finger into his chest, but completely unarmed, and a 75-year-old man, and these officers shove him down, smash his head, and give him a traumatic brain injury. And then the unit that is like, you know, when they try to hold these officers accountable, the whole unit resigns en masse. Like, shit, if they'll kill an old white grandpa, they'll for sure kill any of you. Like a lot of poor white people got to be thinking like, Jesus Christ, that could be me. And they've got experiences with being over policed in their own communities. So it's like, yeah, like these systemic things that, like, you know, are built on these unconscious biases, once you build them, there's something in search of a mission, and if they run out the black people to oppress, they'll slide on down the next segment of society, and they'll keep doing that until you know, we're all fucking in the cage.
I don't think I have a ton more to say about this, but I did want to acknowledge, like, there's probably gonna be some award nominations, I would think, for some of the performances in this film, if not the film itself, although I think there might be for that as well.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if you see picture and director noms for Spike in this film. Yeah.
But man, how do you not get Delroy Lindo as best? I mean, he's the lead, right?
Yeah. He definitely has the most meat to work with, the most pathos to work with, and then I think in the final act, he's also became sympathetic and really connected with me as an audience member. And some of that stuff he did, like that monologue he's doing as he's stomping through the jungle on location, I think was technically hard. Like, he's, you know, he's ripping off 4 or 5 minute long monologues as he's macheting his way through the jungle. And, you know, it's this physical performance of, like, digging his own grave, surrounded by these Vietnamese men. Like, it's real good. It's really strong, powerful work. And I think actually all of the Bloods did really good work. But, like, I wouldn't be surprised to see, like, Clark Peters mentioned for a supporting role. Mm-hmm. You know, because, like, he had the stuff with the Bloods, but he also had some really nice moments with his Vietnamese family. You know, discovering the fact he's got a daughter, and, you know, that was one of the more emotional parts of the resolution of the movie, them kind of reuniting. I don't know. What do you think about the chances?
I think they're good. I was actually wondering if this movie would even be eligible because for Oscars specifically, because there was initial plans to release it in theaters, like a la Roma. Which was released in theaters just to get eligibility in the awards.
Because there is there's a particular rule for Oscars, right? That you can't just have a Netflix premiere.
It actually has to be released in at least one theater in LA County, which it seems very Hollywood centric, but I guess, you know, you do what you do in the industry. But yeah, there were some rules about theatrical releases that needed to happen. So this movie was planned to be released in theaters, but as we all know, the virus shut everything down, COVID, coronavirus shut everything down. So I had to go looking to see if this movie was even going to be eligible for Oscars. And it turns out I think it is. I looked at the eligibility requirements for the 93rd Oscars Academy Awards, and apparently they're waiving some of the release requirements because of the coronavirus. So I do think this is going to be eligible for awards, which is nice, even though it didn't release in theaters because of the shutdown.
Yeah. The thing's going, I guess, against it is very early in the season. Sometimes, you know, things that make a big splash in the beginning of the year get overshadowed later on in, like, the true kind of Oscar season. But on the other hand, like, you know, like I said, you can say it's disjointed, a little messy, but it is very powerful, and the performances are no joke. So I think it's got a lot going for it. And also, it's like, just, you know, you can't pick a better time to release something like this. But, like, you know, something I mentioned on the Three Right Turns podcast, like, this shit happens pretty regularly. Like, there's always a racial flare up in America. This just happens to be one of the biggest ones in, like, 5 years. It's also not even really about that. It has nothing to do with, like, police brutality. It does have a lot to do about systemic you know, racism. The fact that, like, you know, why it was you know, African Americans barely out of single digits represented in our population, but they were, like, 35%+ of our fighting force. You know, and the other 60% were poor white kids. My dad included, you know, poor fucking farmer, poor 18-year-old farmer from Waverly enlisting just to get the hell out of his hometown. I think there's a lot of stuff of the moment. And I think also, you know, there's an appetite for kind of with the Ken Burns documentary to kind of, like, get a 360 degree look at the Vietnam War. You know, like, America's finally ready to come to the grips with this, like, historic defeat it suffered. and, you know, get away from like the Jingo Rambo kind of crap that they directly address in this movie. And, you know, kind of talk about it as with a little bit of distance to it.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully, you know, one of the other things they talk about in this movie is money as it relates to black oppression. And, you know, to a larger degree, a lot of society's ills. And I think we're experiencing that currently where the, you know, wealth gap is becoming larger and larger, not just in, you know, black communities, but also in American communities, period.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully we, you know, we don't take our eye off of either of those balls because they're both important. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what's going to happen with those. Do you think, to go back to the Oscars thing, do you think this virus might actually change permanently the awards requirements? Because this has been kind of under the surface, just bubbling for the last couple of years. Like, you look back at Roma last year, 2018? I can't remember. It was a while ago.
Right.
And that was a huge deal because they only did limited release in theaters just to get eligible for awards. And then Netflix, you know, kept it on their platform mostly.
I mean, maybe, especially if like film becomes like this very niche-y thing to where it's like, you know, if like all the big metroplexes close down or no longer sustainable because, and it's more of a boutique-y kind of thing, it's more of a explicitly art house kind of film release. It seems like it would. Cause I know there's a lot of the Hollywood old guard that are really got their back stiff about this digital release shit. It's like, nah, there's probably reason why you have to air at a particular place in LA County to be considered eligible for it. I think you're right. Maybe to the extent that would have been a 10 or 15, 20 year process normally, that if, you know, you have to, you know, if AMC and Cinemark go bankrupt in the next 3 years, and all you got left is like all Alamo draft houses and like places like the Esquire here in town, you know, then can they like the Oscars either have to give on that or risk becoming even more elitist and irrelevant than they already are?
Yeah.
And they're sensitive to that because, like, you know, the reason they like kept expanding the eligibility to, like, you know, it's like from like 5 or 6 pictures to 12 is because they wanted to get stuff like Batman and the Marvel shit and stuff in there because they were becoming culturally irrelevant. Like, less and less people were watching the films winning Oscars and they were making less and less money. So it's like, oh, well, we need to get some popular films in there so that we don't get to be seen as this elitist out of touch institution. So yeah, I think you're right. Like, and I could
the theater experience to go away entirely.
Yeah,
but I definitely don't. I try not to overvalue it. I think like it's a luxury of film viewing, but it's not a necessity, in my opinion.
I mean, kind of like drive-in theaters, right? You know, we're fortunate enough to live in the Midwest, where it's one of the last bastions of drive-in. And it's a wonderful experience if you've never done it before. It's a unique movie theater experience that you can't get at your home. You can't get in a movie, you know, going into the movie theater. But, like, cinema will survive the death of the drive-in, as it largely has. So I agree. I don't know if it's going to change within the next year or two, but, like, you know, if you do it for the 93rd Oscars, why can't you do it for the 94th and 95th?
Now, it strikes me as, like, I come from a video game background on media consumption stuff primarily. And I look at it as, like, would you exclude a game from getting awards if it wasn't released on a physical disc? That seems asinine, right? That seems like,
right.
What are you trying to say? This is not a video game because it wasn't released on a CD. What about all the floppy disks that were released before? I mean, you're telling me 50 years from now, when nobody even knows what a DVD or Blu-ray is, we're going to somehow discount every single game released? What
is it, the art
look like
that you're judging or the medium? I thought the same when you were saying that. I'm like, also, like, books. Are like books not eligible for awards if they only come out on Kindle?
Right.
I wouldn't surprise me, because, again, there's a lot of shit is like protectionist and a little bit elitist too. But,
or like a hardcover versus soft cover, right? Like,
yeah. This is a trade paperback. It's not eligible. Get in the comic book lane, you fucking chump. don't know. It's weird. It's weird. Isn't it like Spielberg and Scorsese are the big...
They're all 150 years old.
Yeah.
As old as cinema itself.
Yeah, all the old guys that, you know, physically grew up splicing film and doing things quick and dirty. I don't like this shit.
I get it. Like, that's a romantic thing, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, Roger Ebert.
Roger Ebert, in the twilight of his life, campaigned hard against digital projection because 35 millimeter was superior for a long time. But you know what? That's a losing man's bet because, like, yeah. You know, you'll eventually get a screen that can has a projector that has more pixels than a fucking 35 millimeter film stock. You just will. It's the way technology works. So, like, it's one thing to be like, well, I don't want a shitty 1080p projector 50 foot wide. But to say that, like, digital projection is never going to be better than film, it's just dumb.
Is a digital projector better than a film that's been run 100 times?
That's my question. Damn good question. Yeah. Like, he's judging pristine copies, that have never gone through, never been threaded through a projector versus, like, 3 months into its release.
Yeah.
And you throw that in, it's no question. So, yeah. I think technology will march on, and they'll have to either be irrelevant or relax some of those requirements.
Yeah.
Well, that's our film review of the week. It's nice because if you got Netflix, you can watch it right now. So you might have been surprised when we came back with The Five Bloods because we announced last week we were going to do Fruitvale Station because highly relevant. But you know, Spike Lee releases a film that's getting 95% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes 3 days ago. Forgive us for calling an audible and stopping what we're doing and covering that. But next week we'll be back to Fruitvale Station, and we're going to be talking about that. And I hope you join us back next week for that discussion. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you later.